I will open the Senate Committee on Rules for January 27, 2009. Today we have a couple of items on the agenda. The first item, which is going to take up the vast majority of the meeting, is an informational meeting on initiative reform. The second item is merely the introduction of committee measures, which should not take long. The Secretary of State has indicated that she would actually prefer that the Legislative Council let off in this hearing. Gina, would you come forward? And I'm hoping that by the time that you get a minute or so in, the members will realize that it's already time for the committee to be working, and they should be here.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick, and I'm a deputy legislative counsel, and I'm here today to talk about the initiative and referendum measures that were passed in 2007 to kind of set the stage for any work that's done this session. And the main bill that was passed last session is House Bill 2082, and it does a few things that I was going to go over today. A couple of the main things is it requires training and registration for paid petitioner signature collectors and a couple other things. So I'll just go through those fairly briefly, and hopefully this will be helpful. It requires all people being paid to circulate a state initiative referendum or recall petition to register with the Secretary of State. Before a person can do that, they have to undergo a training session that is actually online and basically teaches each signature gatherer that is going to be paid about the general laws regarding initiative and referendum petition gathering, as well as other laws that may affect them, including employment issues. You want me to keep going?
I guess.
Okay. So once they complete that training program, they can register with the Secretary of State, and registration basically includes each person that will be a paid petitioner submitting their name, phone number, maybe not phone number, name, address, a photo, their signature, and a list of the petitions that they will be gathering signatures for. Once they do that and are effectively registered with the Secretary of State, they're required to keep their registration, proof of their registration, with them at all times, including a photo. One of the other things that the bill did was make the chief petitioners liable for any violation that a paid petitioner may commit. It also prevents certain people from becoming paid circulators, and those include any person who's been convicted of a criminal offense involving fraud, forgery, or identification theft within the last 5 years of gathering signatures. The punishment for kind of violating or not complying with these procedures is simply that any signatures that are gathered by a paid petitioner are not allowed to be counted by the Secretary of State. One of the other major things that the bill did was direct the Secretary of State to create templates for signature sheets. The templates are to be used by all signature gatherers, volunteer or paid. The difference is that they're actually different in color, so that people are notified whether there's someone's being paid for their signature gathering and versus being a volunteer. There's also a version of this that's available online, so that a single elector may download it and put their signature on and send it directly to a chief petitioner. And I think this changed the way that these are kind of, this process in the state, I think because of the centralized voter registration in part, these are now not sorted by each signature sheet, wouldn't be sorted by county anymore, it would be sorted by the person's name who gathered those signatures. So, and then they're verified on that basis. The bill also requires circulators to attest that they witnessed the signing of the signature sheet. And again, if they don't do that, the signatures are not to be counted by the Secretary of State. The circulators are prohibited from altering or in any way writing on or changing a person's signature. The only exception is if the person has a disability and requests assistance, or if the person who's providing the signature is willing to initial beside the change that was made by the circulator. Another kind of major change by the bill was to require chief petitioners to maintain accounts. Accounts are defined as the following five things. It can be a contract entered into by a chief petitioner and any person for the purposes of obtaining signatures on a petition. Any records identifying the amount and purpose of each payment made by a chief petitioner to a contractor or subcontractor. An employment manual or other training materials provided to signature gatherers. Any payroll records, including hours worked, number of signatures gathered, and the amount paid, and copies of signature sheets circulated by the paid petitioners. So all of these things now, chief petitioners have to maintain this, which we call accounts, and they must be current, and the Secretary of State is directed to review them periodically, and they are also, because they're required to be current, I think they must be available for review upon request by the Secretary of State. The almost final thing that the bill, House Bill 2082, did was require chief petitioners to appoint a treasurer and file a statement of organization with the Secretary of State and use the ORSTAR system used by candidates currently to keep track of their expenditures and contributions. So they also have to, kind of like a political committee, chief petitioners are required to report any expenditures or contributions that they make. And they do this on the internet using ORSTAR. Finally, there's a little, in order to kind of enforce, it looks like Article 4, Section 1B of the Constitution, which makes it unlawful to pay or receive money based on the number of signatures you obtain. You know, you can be paid to go and collect signatures, but you can't be paid per signature. And so there's a portion of the bill that addresses contractors and subcontractors and basically makes any person that contracts with a chief petitioner to collect signatures liable for any violation of that section of the Constitution if they know of a violation that occurred. Their kind of get-out-of-jail-free card is if once they learn of that, they report it to the Secretary of State. So that's kind of the overview of the bill. Okay. Is there anything else?
Any questions?
Questions?
Sure. The one thing I would ask is, I know that we have it from last session, but if you could work with the committee administrator and just get the committee like a one-page summary, because I think it's going to be important as we consider other pieces of legislation that come to the committee that we have a clear recognition of what was done in the last session. So.
Yeah, that sounds good. That was a great
answer. I can give you a copy of my notes.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Madam Secretary.
Shouldn't we play music when she comes? Dun, dun, dun.
No, there's dun, no red carpet.
Dun, dun. No red carpet. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine.
For the record, Secretary of State Kate Brown, and with me are the folks to answer your very difficult questions. On my right, John Lindbeck, who's director of our Elections Division, and on my left is Summer Davis. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedules to talk about Oregon's initiative system. I really appreciate your interest in this topic. 24 states have some form of direct democracy. As you are probably aware, Oregon's system is probably one of the most active and least restrictive of all the states. I'm certainly a firm believer in Oregon's initiative system. After all, it's what gave women the right to vote.
And I happen to think that's very important. And it is certainly part of our political DNA as Oregonians. And it allows us to participate with or against the legislature in lawmaking, as the case may be. Good morning, Senator Burdick. As I traveled the many corners of the state this past year, I heard from Oregonians all around the state. I'm very frustrated and very concerned about the abuse and fraud taking place in Oregon's initiative system. So the focus of my work this session will be on restoring integrity to Oregon's initiative system. My chief goal is to fully implement House Bill 2082 and fight for the resources to enforce the laws and rules in our signature gathering process. All of you may recall, in 2005, the Oregon legislature initiated the Public Commission on the Legislature. That report, I think, came out in 2006. The Portland City Club also had a report on the initiative system that year as well. Both of those reports encourage more rigorous enforcement of Oregon's signature gathering process than the laws and statutes regarding that. Gina gave you an overview of House Bill 2082, which we passed last session. I just want to mention two things that the bill did to make the initiative process more citizen-friendly. First of all, the petition sheets no longer have to be county-specific. That's courtesy of our Oregon Central Voter Registration Database. It used to be that if you were collecting signatures on a sheet for Multnomah County, you couldn't put Jackson County signatures on that sheet. Now we can have sheets that have all different county signatures on any particular sheet. And secondly, petitions can now be sent through the internet, really making it, frankly, very easy for folks to gather signatures if you have a good email list. In working with stakeholders, we have drafted legislation for the 2009 legislature to fine-tune IRMA, the Initiative Reform Modernization Act, House Bill 2082, and give us some more tools to enforce the laws. I'm not going to go through everything. I'll highlight a few things. We're going to require that signature sheets be turned in on a monthly basis with calendar dates set by administrative rule. And once a petition has reached 50% of required signatures, the Secretary of State may begin the verification process. We're going to increase the time election staff have to register a signature gatherers from 2 days to 5 days within receiving their paperwork, allowing more time for background checks. We would like to allow concurrent civil and criminal enforcement for election law violations relating to initiatives. We'd like to authorize the Secretary of State to reject signatures collected by an individual who's been convicted of fraud, and also authorize the Secretary of State to pull all sheets collected by a circulator who's been found liable, either civilly or criminally, for an election offense under ORS Chapter 260, or who has not been properly registered on the statutes. A few other things. We would clarify that IRMA applies to paid signature gathering for prospective petitions as well as certified for the circulation process. And we would not allow paid circulators to collect signatures on a volunteer basis at the same time they are collecting signatures on a paid basis. We don't want people to avoid ballot measure 26, the paper signature measure. That summarizes the legislation. In addition, we are very interested in having the resources within my office to be able to enforce the statute. In January of 2008, Mr. Lindback was able to piece together the resources to hire one investigator. In my budget, I'm requesting the resources to hire two additional investigators. This has been a complaint-driven process. I believe that the Secretary of State, he or she, should be the policewoman or policeman of the streets and be charged with making sure that signature gatherers are not violating the law. So that's why we're asking for two additional investigators. In addition, given what happened in the Lemons v. Bradbury case, we are asking that the signature gathering process be brought in under the umbrella of the Secretary of State's office. So right now, the signature verification is done at the local level. We are asking that this be done by staff within the state elections office. A couple of reasons. One, to provide uniformity and consistency. Number two, to ease the workload of our county clerks. And three, it's much easier for us to do it now with the centralized voter registration database. I'm also hoping to work with my colleagues, Brad Avaki and our labor commissioner, and our attorney general, John Kroger, to enforce the statutes we currently have on the books. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. And if I'm not able to, I'm sure my two very certified smart folks can answer them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just kind of a resource question. You said that you, first of all, welcome here. I got on the Secretary of State webpage the other day and saw your picture for the first time.
I hope, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I hope was a good one.
It was a very nice picture. You should go look at it. You said that you wanted the authorization to start the validation process once the petitioner had reached 50%. And I just missed the you don't want a mandate that you have to start validating then, do you? Because if someone turned in 50% very close to the deadline, that wouldn't necessarily be something you'd want to do.
Correct.
Okay. And then the validation...
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, just to clarify that we would start the verification process once the petition has reached 50% of the required signatures.
Correct, but you want it to be discretionary because if they reach 50% of the required signatures a month before the deadline, you probably wouldn't want to invoke that, would be my guess.
Coming back.
Well, John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. While it's always helpful to have things be discretionary because, you know, there are always possibly unintended consequences, I think the fact is that we could start, if they turned in a month before 50% of the signatures, we could start them. Any assistance that we can have with starting the process earlier than that 30-day window is a great help to the Elections Division, given our low staffing levels.
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, the other advantage it gives to those gathering signatures is if they find out a month ahead of time that they don't have the necessary signatures, they still have time to collect additional signatures. If they were to wait under the circumstances until the very end and didn't have the signatures, which frankly a number of them did this time around, they're out of luck, at least for that election cycle.
Right. And then, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, the
yes.
Validation right now that you were talking about that you want done in your office instead of the county clerks, that's the validations for the prospective petitions, right? Because don't you already do the validations for the actual signatures?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I'm going to have Mr. Lindback answer that question, but the signature verification is currently done at the county level.
For all... like 10 billion signatures?
Well, we use, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, we use a statistical sampling method.
Right, but what I mean is for the whole pot, because that's news to me, and I've been a petitioner, and they were all down in the basement of the Capitol counting away, and I thought that it was already through your office.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, what we're doing in the basement of the Capitol is we sort the petition sheets when they first come in and review them for circulator to make sure that the circulators did their job, signing them, numbering them, et cetera. We sort them. We get them ready to send to the counties. But the actual verification of the signatures is done by the county clerk and the county clerk's staff. Right now, the prospective petitions under the new law, when somebody hands in their 1,000 signatures, within the Elections Division, we are doing that. But when it comes to the full petitions, when they're handed in, under the law, they would still go to the county clerk for verification. And another complicating factor is that with this new law that allows mixed signatures on a sheet, we have county clerks verifying signatures of citizens not within their county. That's made them a little restless, that whole issue, and lends itself more logically to the state doing the verification of signatures on state petitions. The county clerks will continue to verify signatures on county petitions and city petitions and district petitions, but for state petitions, under the proposal, we would move that the actual verification of the signatures into the Secretary of State's office.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional questions? Yes, Senator Ferriero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you circle back for me and talk again about the issue of petitioners, denial of petitioner certification to folks that have been found guilty of fraud, that kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, of course. House Bill 2082, which the legislature passed last session, prohibits a person who's been convicted of fraud, ID theft, or who has had a conviction within the last 5 years from being a paid signature gatherer.
Mr. Chairman, I like that provision. I think that's a good provision, but I'm kind of curious about a procedural question. When does a person lose their right to vote, their franchise, and how is it restored if they've lost it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferriero, I just want to add the other criminal conviction is forgery.
Yeah, makes sense.
So, conviction of a crime.
Senator Ferriero, if when someone is in prison, in the custody of the State Department of Corrections, they are not allowed to vote under Oregon law and the Constitution. Once they are out of the custody of the State Department of Corrections, they can vote.
Mr. Chairman, that gets to the issue that I wanted to raise. I mean, even though I kind of like the idea of keeping folks with active fraud convictions from working on a petition, you know, or forgery, I mean, that seems to just make sense. If the state restores a franchise after a person is released from incarceration, is it constitutional to deny franchise, which is full participation in the initiative process?
Can we get a clarification of that, though, Senator Ferriero? They would not be denied to sign the petition themselves, but full participation would be actually to be able to circulate also.
That's my point. Yeah. I'm just saying, you know, if somebody really drilled into this thing to see if there's a question of franchise that may be unanswerable by the mechanism that we've designed. I mean, if you're going to take franchise away from a person, either a person's fully vested or they're not. And I understand that they're not fully vested while they're incarcerated, but when they're out, they're fully vested. So how is it that you can sort of parse the question and say, for certain crimes, you just don't get your full franchise?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferriero, the crimes are limited to crimes that tend to have some relationship to the signature gathering process. As I said, forgery.
Forgery and frippery. I get
forgery,
that.
Forgery and ID theft.
No, I get that.
And I will note that my recollection is that we did not receive a legislative council concern last session when we drafted on the bill on that particular issue. So while it may be subject to challenge, I'm guessing given the significant correlation between the conviction and the type of paid activity that folks are being asked to do, I think we would pass constitutional muster. I will point out, Mr. Vice Chair, that someone who has a conviction of fraud, forgery, or ID theft may be a volunteer signature gatherer. So that also may be a distinction there as well.
One of the things you learn after a few trips around the track in this building is if you don't ask the right question, people don't necessarily feel obligated to give you the right answer.
No.
So I guess I would suggest that if we didn't get a legislative council opinion on whether or not that is an unacceptable abridgment of franchise, maybe it'd be a good idea.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferriero, I'm sure if you asked for one, they would be more than delighted to give you one.
It might avoid a trip to the court by having that information.
Mr. Chair, Sarah Farrelly, as far as I know, no one has yet challenged that provision of House Bill 2082.
Any additional questions? One question I would have is in terms of the centralized verification. Currently, you do not compensate the county clerks for that verification, do you?
Mr. Chair, no, we don't.
Okay. And my memory is correct. I don't know what's in your budget, but the last time this was considered, the figure was about $300,000. Is that in the ballpark?
Mr. Chair, I think the exact figure is about $524,000. That includes the additional investigators that we're asking the legislature to fund.
Okay.
But as usual, your memory is correct.
Okay, for the actual. Well, when somebody's trying to get the fiscal down for something, the fiscal gets smaller. Okay, any additional questions? Thank you very much for coming here today. And I'm sure as we have other bills coming before this committee that affect the initiative process, you will have somebody watching the hearings.
Mr. Chair, we will have folks watching this committee very closely. And if you have committee members who did not participate in the summer hearing regarding House Bill 2082, we are more than happy to send the testimony that Mr. Lindbach prepared regarding some of the implications of House Bill 2082 to committee members. Okay, we'll go ahead and do that.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Olney, will you come forward? Committee members, while she's getting prepared, this week is basically both informational and public hearings on an initiative reform proposals. For Thursday, I basically took the initiative reform proposals that we actually had in the hopper and just put them on the agenda, just so that we get a feel for these issues, as probably later in the process we may come back to a few. So please proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Margaret Olney, and I am Special Counsel in the Office of the Attorney General. And I'm here today as a resource to the Secretary of State. We have been consulted and generally support the ideas that have been put forward regarding the initiative reform and improving the process and our ability to enforce the laws that we currently have. In particular, there is a desperate need for the additional funding of investigators in order to allow us in the Attorney General's office to assist in enforcing these laws. What I was asked to talk about is the ballot title review process, which is something that is within the purview of the Attorney General's office and which is of significant interest, and I think that there may be proposals from stakeholders to revise that process because it is often viewed as an area in which there is frankly, political game playing going on. So first, I thought I'd just review exactly what the ballot title components are and sort of what that process is, and then be available to answer questions. The ballot title is viewed and is set out basically as an important and essential tool for voters to know what they're voting on. The goal should be, is there information here that will enable a voter to cast an informed vote? The ballot title in its entirety is printed on some ballots, but not all. There are three components. The first is a caption, which is 15 words, and the caption by statute is intended to identify the subject of the measure. The second part are the yes and no vote results statements. Those are 25 words long, and as the name suggests, the goal is to say what happens if you vote yes and what happens if you vote no. The yes statement often includes some fiscal effects, but not always. The no vote statement usually describes current law because, of course, if there's a no vote, if you vote no, then the status quo continues. The summary is the longer piece. It's 125 words. It generally starts with a description of current law, again, giving the background so people can be informed, and then describes how the measure works and its major effects. Again, the caption is always on the ballot. The no, yes and no vote result statements are actually on the ballot itself, and then the summary is in some counties and some ballots is included. The ballot title is also used on the prospective petition sheet. Once the petition gets a ballot title, it's on the signature gathering sheet. And theoretically, it is supposed to be used as a means for folks to know whether or not they actually want to sign an initiative. I think in reality, it is not a particularly useful tool there. It is much more useful in the ballot box and in the voter's pamphlet. The ballot title review process is one that the Attorney General's office is heavily involved in. The Attorney General drafts the ballot title, then makes it available for public comment. There's a circulation list. Electors who are interested can submit comments on that. Typically, comments identify problems in the draft ballot title and alternatives. The Attorney General considers all those comments and issues a certified ballot title, which can then be appealed to the Oregon Supreme Court directly. The process is quite expedited. It happens very quickly. There's basically 10-day timelines, 10 business day timelines for each step, and it goes incredibly quickly. For the Attorney General's office, the appellate division is responsible for doing that, it can be an incredibly intrusive piece of workload. Particularly in the last couple cycles, it has been quite common for chief petitioners to file 13 on one day, and that can be an overwhelming workload because from then every step of the process is key to the same timeline. It's also challenging for electors who participate in that process. The court's review is deferential. The court cannot simply reject a ballot title because it thinks it could be better. The ballot title could be better. Rather, it can only reject it if the court determines that it does not substantially comply with the statutory standards. The concerns that many stakeholders have surfaced about the ballot title process include sort of the ballot title shopping. I think this is part of what drove the requirement in 2082, House Bill 2082, for 1,000 signatures instead of the previous 25. We don't yet know really how much that is going to affect the process. Currently, we are behind. There's 30 initiatives have been filed for the 2010 cycle. At this time, for the 2008 cycle, there were 60. And of those that have been filed for 2010, only 3 have been filed post-implementation of House Bill 2082, although there are 6 in the hopper right now. Chief Petitioner Bill Sizemore has submitted 6 prospective petitions the signatures are being verified, and then presumably if there are enough signatures, the ballot title drafting process will begin on those 6. The concern has been that the ballot titles, often very similar initiatives, are submitted and tweaked just a little bit in order to get a different ballot title. Ballot titles are then used for fundraising and it is often difficult to know what's different, why one is different than the other, and it also certainly invites litigation over the ballot title. The cost of the ballot title process is borne by the Attorney General's office, and it was approximately $233,000 in the last cycle. This is comparable to what it's been in previous cycles. And the Judicial Department obviously has a significant, bears a significant burden. The Oregon Supreme Court has to deal with these as opposed to other cases. They don't quantify their time. They don't keep track of how many hours they work on a case the way the Attorney General does. So it's a little hard to know exactly what that time is. There's also a significant amount of concern about whether or not the ballot title itself is as informative as it could be. The caption, many people feel the caption is too short to really identify the subject of a measure, and that the caption becomes unuseful or distorts really what the effect is. There is a lack in the ballot title of clear notice to voters about the fiscal impact of measures. And if you give that information to voters, there's a feeling that they may if they understood either that it's going to reduce services or mandate, you know, mandate activities, that they would vote differently, or at least we think they should know that, or and that's often a criticism. And then just the language is difficult to understand. I have been in focus groups where, you know, the complaint is, my God, lawyers must have drafted this. And, you know, of course lawyers drafted it. And, it's, you know, you have a 15-page initiative to try to get down into 15 words. It is a challenge in the best of circumstances. There often are criticisms about the ballot title process and the review process being used for delay while a ballot title is being challenged. The chief petitioner cannot circulate that ballot title. I think that that is an issue that has not been as prevalent in the last couple cycles. Chief petitioners are typically filing their initiatives much earlier in the earlier, so that it's not quite that last minute. And I would note that court review is a meaningful part of the process. In both 2008 and 2010, the majority of the ballot titles that have been appealed, the court has sent it back for modification. So they're not being used sort of frivolous, you know, they're not frivolous appeals. I mean, the majority have prevailed, notwithstanding the deferential standard of review. So that's the process and the framework of the current system.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Olney?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Ballot title shopping. That is an issue that interests me because I think it has more to do with how and who writes the ballot title than anything. I mean, I think we have to assume, Mr. Chair, that a person who wants, who goes to the effort of trying to get a ballot, you know, an initiative on the ballot, also wants to maximize the opportunity to pass the thing. And I don't think it's any secret in state government there's a fairly high hostility factor towards some of the ballots that are proposed. And there's a demonstrable suspicion that ballot titles are written by people that want them to fail in some cases. And I think that's what drives the multiplicity of ballot titles or ballot title requests coming to the process, because people don't trust it to produce a ballot title that, you know, is sellable and accurately reflects the objectives. And I think that's one of the reasons why you see these multiples. Raising the bars is not necessarily a bad idea, because, you know, maybe it'll cut down the volume. Maybe they'll be more careful. But I don't see what is inherently bad about wanting to make sure the wording has the highest potential for passage. And I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that a person that wants a ballot passed would look for that kind of language. So what's inherently bad about shopping it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair. I think that the issue is not necessarily as inherently bad, although I do think that it has led to a public cynicism about the process somewhat, and that what happens is that the goal is not, in drafting the initiative, is to tweak the content or to hide what's actually happening in order to achieve, to get the ballot title that makes it sellable at the expense of good policy, or that makes that really fundamentally changes what initiative is going to do. But certainly there have been plenty of people who have talked about, you know, if ballot titles, if initiatives are substantially similar, should we be giving them the same ballot title? And the devil's in the details about that in terms of what does substantially similar mean. There are, for 2008, for example, there were 157 initiatives filed, and of those, only 45 were concepts that hadn't been either in a prior cycle, submitted in a prior cycle, or in this cycle. But the concepts are not, you know, they're not identical. There would be things that would be omitted. So, depending on what, you know, the problems are vetted and surfaced by the ballot title. So I think it's, obviously getting the ballot title, a ballot title is an incredibly important piece of the political process, and opponents of initiatives are going to want to get a ballot title that they think accurately reflects and gives voters the information that they need in order to vote no, and the proponents are going to do it in the other side. I think that this Attorney General's office has bent over backwards, however, to be as neutral and not be anti the initiative, and I think that part of the proof of that might well be that opponents, people who have challenged ballot title, the Attorney General's ballot titles historically, have prevailed more often than they've lost before the Oregon Supreme Court. So it's not that the Attorney General has been twisting the law to have a no.
Mr. Chair, follow on.
Yes.
Well, you characterize folks that submit ballot titles in multiplicities are somehow trying to tweak or hide. That indicates to me there's deep suspicion in the agency about ballot title shopping and the motives and all those things. But if that's true, how does the agency function as a truly not independent third-party arm's-length broker of that information? I mean, you know, your charge is to create a ballot title that accurately reflects the petition, notwithstanding there may be several that are almost identical or slightly different. But if there's a suspicion in the agency that that's somehow trying to hide or tweak, how do you remove that sort of predisposition and suspicion and deliver a product? I mean, I think that's what the petitioners are talking about when they complain about the limitations on their right to access the system. So I guess I'd like to hear you talk about how do you overcome your suspicion and deliver the product that's impartial?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, I think that it is not when you see the ballot titles coming, initiatives that are getting filed that are substantially similar, and plenty of them get the exact same ballot title that have been litigated before. And I think the Attorney General's office is absolutely committed to having a neutral and fair description of that. But when you get bombarded and they do one, I think it's just a natural system. Now, I am also speaking, as somebody who has been outside of the Attorney General's office, involved in this process in my previous position, so I'm also aware of what those on the outside view that process as being, and it's one in which it's an incredibly difficult task. The Attorney General's task is extremely difficult, and every time somebody looks at it, there are ways that ballot title can be improved over time because it is such a difficult task to distill sometimes complicated, not particularly well thought out in terms of legally, organized just like what exactly is going on here, and to distill that into a ballot title. It's an incredibly challenging process. I think everybody would agree to that. And I think the Attorney General's office has a high responsibility and takes that very seriously.
Senator Farioli, if I might intercede here too, I think it's part of what you both said is quite true. The person putting forward the initiative is obviously trying to put it forward and have it passed. So they obviously want language that would help ensure that it passes. The person that is opposing the ballot title on the outside obviously doesn't want it to have language that will benefit it in passing, so that they are objecting to the ballot title and probably bringing up reasons why it should be worded differently. And I think the Attorney General is put actually in the end, the Attorney General and the courts are put in the middle of that to come up with the most objective statement that they can come up with. Now, I think part of this may be a little, at least portion of this discussion, not all of it, not predisposition or any of that, but maybe moot now to some degree, because ballot title shopping, if there was such an issue, was constantly debated on the basis that it only took 25 initiatives to start the process, and therefore I got more than enough people in this room to sit and do 100 initiatives here in the next hour and a half if I had them written out and they could just sign all of the things. At 1,000 signatures, verified signatures each, I don't think you're going to have as many alternatives being proposed. But we all, I mean, it's hard to deny anything being behind this dais. We all deal in issues where we test words, where we have polling to see which words work the best, which words convey the message the most clearly, and I would expect anybody wanting to pass an initiative petition would do the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's exactly the point. The point is that, you know, if I could use the vernacular, either your ballot title at the end of the process sucks or it rules. And I think the problem is that perhaps people that are writing the ballot titles have personal feelings about the petitioner or personal feelings about the objective. And, you know, it would be hard to convince me that that didn't somehow enter into the discussion because, you know, multiple submissions lead people to believe somebody's trying to tweak or hide. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is that as long as we all realize that language is really, really important, and you only get 15 words, it's like writing a billboard. It's very difficult to do. And people have different opinions about whether or not it's been done fairly, accurately, or most efficiently for their objectives, either pass it or kill it. I don't know that we should really be concerned with trying to put such limitations on the process. And I guess what leads me to believe that is I'm holding a whole sheaf of email correspondence and correspondence back and forth on Measure 37, which is clearly details in great specificity the ballot title shopping that went on in the petition for Measure 49. And the roster of people that are corresponding and writing the ballot title is who's who of Oregon politics. And I personally, I don't see anything wrong with it. You know, I don't know why we should be so concerned about whether or not people get the best opportunity to participate fully to their advantage in the process. It strikes me that limiting those things is a pointless exercise because people, if they need 1,000, they'll get 1,000.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I think it's absolutely clear that wordsmithing and words and language is important. I think that, and the Attorney General does not have a position, and we don't have any proposals to change the ballot title drafting process. I was simply identifying what I think many people believe is a concern about that process. And the fundamental concern is whether or not the process is one that leads to good public policy. In terms of what's in the ballot titles and how those get, and what's in the measure.
Mr. Chairman, good public policy, I'll decide.
I think that is the point, but
it's utterly in the eye of the beholder, Mr. Chairman.
But I think the issue in terms of good public policy is the accuracy of representation of what is before the voter, not the issue of what is the actual item.
It would be good process, honestly brokered. That would be good public policy. But, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to submit these emails and correspondence on ballot title shopping for the record, and I'll do that through the appropriate committee staff.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, if there are any closing remarks that you want to have, please proceed.
No, as I say, thank you, Mr. Chair. My goal here today was to provide background information. The Attorney General does not have any legislation that we are proposing on this, we will continue to be available to the Secretary of State and to this committee on resources and legal analysis or resources about the process and how it impacts our workload and the process.
Thank you very much for coming here today. Appreciate it. I'm going to call Ryan Deckard and Tim Nesbitt up together.
I could, but I didn't.
Such restraint.
I know. I've amazed myself.
Thank you.
I don't think I can show the same respect as Deckard, though.
Mr. Deckard, would you mind? Someone have a cell phone on? Any? We have a problem in this room in that even if a cell phone is silent, if it is still on, it affects the audio system. So please proceed, Mr. Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan Deckard, the president of the Oregon Business Association and avid fan of Milli Vanilli. OBA advocates for the long-term enhancement of Oregon's business environment and quality of life, providing statewide business leadership ranging from Oregon's largest farm to our two Fortune 500 companies. Mr. Chair, you have heard a great deal of testimony about both the fraud concerns that folks have and the ballot title shopping and ballot title reform process. OBA's Good Government Committee got interested in this issue about a year ago after looking at the initiative process and really concluding one thing in particular, that as you review the citizen initiative, the missing element is citizen. And so we have been working over the past year with a very broad, I know we see broad coalitions in this building, a extremely broad coalition of business, labor, good government groups, all around the three areas that you're hearing about this afternoon. I think you'll hear perhaps again Thursday. One is constitutional initiatives that Senator Morris and Representative Galizio have been leading the charge within that coalition of business, labor, and other interested parties. And the core initiative that seems to be gathering the most interest is the indirect initiative, which would simply allow you as elected representatives the ability, as they do in Washington and other states, the ability to look at an initiative before it goes to the voters and have the opportunity to review and put your thoughts as elected representatives into place. The two other areas, Mr. Chair, are what we think will be a strong statutory package looking at some of the issues that Secretary Brown mentioned, and then the process that Mr. Nesbitt has led around the ballot title reform and ballot title review, working in concert with the Revenue Reform Task Force and doing what we think of as an excellent job of gathering most of the folks around the state that are concerned about this into what we think of as a really strong coalition that's asking to add the citizen back into the citizen initiative process. With that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for the opportunity to testify before this august committee.
Mr. Deckard, you understand if I open this up for questions that those questions may be on target and they may not be on target, but I will do that anyway. Do you have any questions, Senator Atkinson? Are you going to resist?
No.
Senator Farioli.
No questions.
Thank you. You got by easily. Mr. Nesbitt.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, Deputy Chief of Staff of the Governor and participant in the OBA-led effort to look at reforms to the initiative process, in particular a work group related to the whole issue of ballot titles, which you've been covering in your prior questioning of the witnesses who preceded me. In my work group, we had representation from AOI as well as the Oregon Restaurant Association and the former state treasurer. And we did reach consensus on a few issues, which you've already joined in the earlier questions today. Number one is what should be required before final ballot titles are issued and adjudicated before you go through that lengthy process. And the other is how can ballot titles be better presented to improve the voters' understanding of their complexity and often their costs. In the first instance, I think you've rightly pointed out that with the new 1,000 signature requirement, we're probably going to see a reduction in the number of measures that get filed and therefore the number of ballot titles that get prepared and therefore the costs associated with adjudicating those titles. So I would acknowledge there's a little less sense of the compelling need to look at these kinds of reforms that I present to you in the first category here, but we still think they're valid for consideration. With whatever level of signatures is required to start the process, as you heard in the prior testimony, there's then a process which ends up with a test of whether a measure complies with the single subject or single amendment requirements of the Constitution, the award of a final ballot title, and the approval to circulate. All three of those things relate to the initial filing with the now 1,000 signatures. The question we raise is whether the ballot title should be one of those three, or whether it's drafting, commenting, and adjudication of the final title should be delayed to later in the process. You heard the Secretary of State talk about a proposed requirement to start the verification of signatures upon submission of 50% of those required. If that were adopted, you could also at that point defer the ballot titling until that phase of the process. You would then have even fewer, which would get to the whole appeals stage, and therefore less cost associated with adjudicating the title. And you would really get more connected to the idea that a ballot title means what that phrase suggests. It's a title that's awarded to a measure which is in fact qualifying or likely to qualify for the ballot, as opposed to one that's been drafted, perhaps just to test what language it gets. You'd then have to have a circulating title to do the circulation of petitions, which we think is, for anybody who's observed the signature gathering or participated in it, as I have, I don't think it's a major issue. You're going to be carrying the full text of the measure with you in any case as a circulator. And most voters want to have a little discussion about what's there, and they don't usually look at the title at that instance. Secondly, you'd have to separate. We then end up separating the whole issue of challenging ballot titles just to delay the approval to circulate. Approval to circulate could happen more expeditiously, and the ballot title issue could be joined when the stakes are not whether a measure gets to go forward to collect signatures, but whether we think we got the right verbiage to properly summarize and present to the voters the impacts of these measures. The other category of changes we looked at has to do with the format and the presentation of ballot titles to the voters. As you heard in prior testimony, every county prints at least the caption and yes-no statements. That means we have 65 words to work with. But that lead caption of 15 words seems to get all the attention. I refer to that as the shrink wrap for these sometimes very complicated measures. And if you can get a good 15 words, you're either ahead of the game or if not behind the game when it comes to the presentation of ideas to the voters. Is there a better way, as long as we have 65 words to work with, to communicate to the voters the complexity of these issues that they don't necessarily stop with or get drawn in by those 15 words? And I would suggest we ought to be looking at formulations that may be just a 65-word paragraph. If that's what we're going to put on the ballot, every voter would see that. Every voter would at least get to read that much about the impact of the measure. Secondly, as you know, we do call attention to the constitutional amendments, if that's what a ballot measure is. We lead with that standard language, amends constitution. We think it would be helpful to call attention to measures which have significant cost for the state and those which would, in effect, unbalance the budgets you adopt every 2 years, if not more frequently, by cutting the resources available for services already committed to services, or by mandating new spending for which you don't have the resources. We looked at different formulations. I outlined them here on my handout. But we do think probably the most compelling need of all here is to make sure we're properly calling attention to voters of measures which will have significant fiscal impacts and either reduce the resources you have available to balance the budget or mandate new spending which will unbalance your budget. So that's just the summary of the changes we've discussed. And again, this went forward with a broad consensus from the work group and seemed to have a lot of support in the larger coalition led by OBA.
Any questions for Mr. Nesbitt? Senator Ferriola.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I really think that your assessment of the mechanisms by which we could take pressure off the ballot title shopping issues are good. I noticed in the prepared testimony it said that there'll be less incentive to secure a killer ballot title. There'll also be less incentive to prepare a ballot title killer. The whole concept of ballot title shopping seems to me to be you know, it might be inconvenient, it might even be a little bit expensive, but it certainly is not fatal to the process in any way. And it's perfectly logical to assume people are going to want to get the best title they can get. It's also logical if people fundamentally disagree with the initiative process or don't like the outcomes. And we're, you know, there's no point in mischaracterizing that. There's a whole lot of people in this building and in this process that fundamentally disagree with the outcomes and don't like them and don't like the process and wish it were less accessible to Oregonians. I think the challenge for us is to make sure that we don't let those personal feelings get insinuated into the process. So I have to say that I think of all of us in this room, Mr. Nesbitt, you probably have the most experience in the petitioning process. I've only been a chief petitioner once, I think, perhaps Senator Burdick once or twice, I didn't get much involved in the wording of the language. I was sort of recruited, you know, to get into the process. I guess I'd just like to hear your comment. Do you think there's anything inherently bad about wanting the best ballot title you can get and even submitting more than one petition to get one?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, I think if we leave it to the proponents to draft their own ballot titles, I think we're pretty much surrendering any effort at objectivity. You basically then let the drafters not only draft the measure, but draft the marketing slogan, the 15 words that goes with it. Mm-hmm. And I would rather us continue to make the effort, even though outcomes may be imperfect. For instance, with the involvement of the AG's office and the final say by the courts to determine what titles meet certain standards as spelled out in your statutes. And at least make the effort at that kind of objectivity. Probably in any given circumstance, there'll be dozens of ballot titles which would pass the statutory standards. But there are dozens more which wouldn't. And I think all we can do is make the effort to start with an objective drafting and allow a third party to determine what meets the standards and what doesn't.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, I want to, you know, in light of the testimony that was presented from the DOJ today about the suspicion that tweaking and hiding go on with multiple ballot titles, I guess I'd like to see some assurances that they're being written with perfect objectivity, or you know, there is no such thing as perfect objectivity. And maybe that's what we really have to acknowledge. And,
right. And
if the process can be improved, we ought to improve it. But I don't know that we do any service to democracy by making it impossible or impossibly difficult to achieve. I think we should expect people are going to want to get the best ballot title and make the most transparent, easiest mechanism for them to achieve that.
Mr. Nesbitt, did you care to respond? Or?
I think I did already. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. One question. It hasn't even come up in this discussion here. 15 words. Is that really adequate in terms of, I know you have the items that come after that, but is 15 words really adequate to describe
it'll be a committee bill later in the
a very significant and complex measure?
Mr. Chair, I think not, and that's the question we raised about the caption getting all the attention. It's not that we're walking into polling booths any longer. We're getting printed ballots in our homes, and every county commits at least 65 words right on the ballot to presenting it to the voters. And I think what we're looking at here is something of a relic of when we used to have, you know, the polling place kind of ballot. Yeah. And we should, as long as every county is saying they can fit 65 words for each measure on a ballot, we should take another look at how we construct that so we're not overemphasizing that 15-word slogan, that shrink wrap for what can be a very complicated set of changes. And I think we'll do better if voters are reading 65 words that spell it all out for them rather than those top 15.
Any additional questions?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
citizens can have 350 or 500 words, too. I mean, the proponents and the opponents have free access to the voter's pamphlet, and notwithstanding the thing is starting to look like a phone book rather than a...
Or two phone books.
Two phone books, yeah.
That's right. I think that I would rather go in the direction of allowing a free and unfettered opportunity for debate than, you know, try to squeeze the thing down. So I think, you know, I don't see any reason to change the ballot title process. Adding more words probably isn't going to hurt anything, but there's also a safety mechanism at the other end, and that's the voter's pamphlet statement that any citizen can buy.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you both for coming here today. I'm going to close this informational hearing, open a work session. The work session is to basically approve as a committee bill LC 1272-2. This is the annual sessions bill. This bill leaves off specific dates in terms of the length of sessions, just because that is subject to future debate. And at the suggestion of Mr. Johnson, Dexter Johnson, it actually has included a couple of things that normally has not appeared in this bill before, and that's to avoid confusion, which is that, that in terms of the end-of-session forecast, that is in the odd-numbered year, so no one confuses that we are changing or having two different end-of-session forecasts potentially impacting a kicker, and two, that redistricting occurs by the legislature in the odd-numbered year for that process. So, Madam Committee Administrator, if you want to add something more. Or
the third was the e-board. It would keep e-board appointment at the end of the odd year, and their jurisdiction would run through until the beginning of the next odd year.
Yeah. Obviously, an introduction of a committee measure is not a statement of support or opposition. It's merely just a process for introduction. Is there a motion to adopt?
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the committee bill LC 1272-2. He introduces a committee bill.
Are there any objections to the introduction? Seeing no objection, motion passes. Committee, we are done for today. We'll be back here on Thursday. We will have three bills up for public hearing only on Thursday. We will have one minor work session item, but not a bill. I mean, we're not passing anything out onto the floor. So, yes.
Mr. Chairman, I made reference to some documents that were acquired through the Freedom of Information Act form, and it's a virtual primer on ballot title shopping. So if any person is curious about how it's done and done very well, these are the memoranda on Measure 49.
Okay.
And I will.
And you already asked for those to be introduced, and that was part of the informational hearing. So thanks. And with that, we're done until Thursday.